is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Rest! You tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome. This is the live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the all-out struggle for truth on the internet airwaves since 2006 from an old ice cream trailer currently parked somewhere in the woods of Western Wisconsin at a thoroughly undisclosed location. But I will be at a somewhat less undisclosed location soon, moving to Morocco. I'll tell you more about that later. First, let's get into what's happening in tonight's show. In the second hour, Barry Kissin points out that the censors want to tell us that they need to be able to purge the internet of all dissent because dissenters are inspired by, gasp, Vladimir Putin. It's all Putin's fault. All that disinformation, misinformation, and everything that doesn't toe the party line is Putin's fault. Barry Kissin says that this business of blaming everything on Putin and the Russians is getting way out of hand, heading for World War III, et cetera. So that's the big deal in the second hour. Barry Kissin, by the way, is an expert on the 2001 anthrax false flag attacks. Speaking of which, we have an even bigger anthrax / bioware expert on here in the first hour. That's Meryl Nass. She is well known for her COVID truth-telling and for getting witch-hunted by the various authorities in the state of Maine overseeing medical licensing and things like that. And she's standing tall and calling it the way she sees it, putting out a lot of great information on her Substack, which we're going to talk about. So, hey, without further ado, welcome, Meryl Nass. How are you, Meryl?
Hello. How are you? I'm good.
I'm good, too. I'm drinking decaf, but you wouldn't know it from the way I'm talking. So,
Morocco. That's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge change. It's kind of a wild, crazy adventure, but it's all maktub. That is the will of Allah. So I'm down with it.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I certainly enjoyed my time in Morocco, and I have a friend who went to Morocco recently, and perhaps because the food was of so much better quality, a lot of her medical issues went away while she was there.
You know, I found that I experience extra good health in Morocco, too, and it probably is partly the good food. As long as you're not eating too much French bread and putting too much sugar in your mint tea, you're going to eat pretty well over there.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope you can come visit, actually, Meryl. We are hoping to bring some influencers over there and, you know, come stay with us and give a couple of talks and that sort of thing. And you're definitely on the list.
Whereabouts will you be in Morocco?
Saidia, which is on the Algerian border. On the beach. It's the best beach in Africa, some say. Really, really nice Mediterranean beach. And it's a part of Morocco that foreign tourists don't really visit that much, which I like, actually. And you can always go from there to other parts of Morocco where the tourists do visit, like Fez and Marrakesh and Chefchaouen and all those cool places. But where we are, there are a lot of, I like the intellectual side of the University of Oujda. There are a bunch of, to my mind, kind of authentic, you know, uncorruptible type people there. You know, there's a history of supporting the Algerian Revolution from Oujda and Eastern Morocco. And there's, so those, you know, they're truth lovers, and they're, you know, they are proud of their culture, their traditional culture, and not really down with the New World Order forcing one size fits all, you know, woke world down everybody's throats.
Absolutely. So I've spent a lot of time, you know, I was in Morocco for a month 50 years ago, but I've been in Spain a lot more recently, going to southern Spain and visiting the Moorish ruins and understanding what an advanced culture there was when the Moors took over much of Spain in around 800 and continued to occupy and rule much of Spain until they were slowly forced back into Africa by 1492, which was the last bastion of the Islamic people in what's the town? It's a beautiful town in Spain.
There's Cordoba, and there's of course the Alhambra at Granada.
Granada was where Ferdinand and Isabella conquered the last city of the Moorish Empire. At the same time, they were giving Columbus money to go conquer the United States or wherever it was he was going.
Yeah, if you want to read a really fun revisionist history of all of that by somebody who argues that Islamic Spain was sort of the highest point of human civilization, try Maria Menocal's book, The Ornament of the World. It's a good book. And, you know, some folks say, well, that's painting too rosy a picture. But seriously, it was, you know, I think there were something like, you know, dozens of times more books in the library in Cordoba alone than in all of Christian Europe at one point. And clearly that was the most advanced culture in Europe for quite a long time. And a lot of great things came from it into Europe, like the amour courtois, courtly love traditions, the troubadour poetry, that sort of thing. Ironically, a lot of people think that, you know, the West invented romantic love and treating women well and all that sort of thing. Actually, women were considered, they were property. Legally, they were property in the West. And Islam made women equals in the sense that they, too, are, you know, equal property owners. They're not property. And this thing called futua, or chivalry, was inspired by certain kinds of, you know, Sufi warrior orders and things like that, these kind of warrior monks who were, if the Islamic ethos is to treat civilians and especially women really, really, really well. Of course, that was sometimes honored more in the breach and the observance, but there, it still was an ideal in Islamic culture. And then that filtered into Southern Europe, and that's where the whole courtly love troubadour thing came from.
People also are often not aware that while the Moors were in charge, the Jews, the Catholics, and the, you know, people of Islam got along fine together. There was no problem. And it was only when Ferdinand and Isabella really got the Inquisition going that they threw out all the Moors as well as the Jews. You convert or die or move if you can get out. So it's, and then, as you know, many Jews went to Morocco and Algeria and settled there and had cultures that thrived. A lot of not well-known history.
Yeah, and then it gets especially interesting because this very thriving Moroccan Jewish culture was ethnically cleansed by the Israelis in the 1950s. They terrorized Moroccan Jews like Iraqi Jews and Yemeni Jews and other Jews of that part of the world, or the MENA region, into fleeing. And to do that, They paid off the Moroccan government, so they had free reign to do whatever they wanted. They terrorized the Jews. And actually, the worst thing they did was sinking a ship with Jewish people heading for Israel. This was in the early 60s, I forget which year, in order to create a huge PR story and garner enough sympathy to raise a lot of funds to basically force the rest of the Moroccan Jews out and ship them off to Israel. And the Moroccans, they're inviting the Zionist Jews back. They say, you know, if you're a Moroccan Jew, you're still a Moroccan, you're always a Moroccan, and you're always welcome to come back.
How interesting. Fabulous. Fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let's get into the free speech side of things, because, you know, all of these kinds of opinions that we're throwing around, some of them are going to offend somebody, and maybe somebody who gets offended is going to have some power, and they're going to try and shut us up. And this is the world we've been increasingly living in. And you've been tracking the battle against censorship on your Substack. You know, you've been fighting censorship yourself, of course, in many different ways. And there have been a lot of really interesting developments just this week. So maybe you could start, pick one and talk about it.
Okay. So, so what happened in the last few years, only in the last 3 to 5 years, is the government, the U.S. government, along with governments elsewhere, many governments around the world, got the idea simultaneously that they could fool their populations into thinking that there was such a crime as misinformation, disinformation, and or malinformation, and that they should encourage citizens to guard against this. This was a great danger to public health and to God knows what else. And they should be reporting on this. So the Surgeon General issued a brochure about how every sector of society needed to guard against misinformation, malinformation, and each had a role to play. You know, NGOs could donate money for this purpose, and companies could do this, and education that, blah, blah, blah. And the Department of Homeland Security issued a warning that, you know, people spreading misinformation, disinformation could be considered terrorists, et cetera. Now, what's super important for everybody to understand is that the First Amendment, which is the Constitution, is the basis of U.S. law. So every decision that's made by the Supreme Court and by judges around the country is supposed to be based on what is in the Constitution. The Bill of Rights was the first 10 amendments, which had to be passed in order to get the Constitution passed way back in the 1780s, 1780s, sorry. So the First Amendment is freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press. And what that means is censorship is not allowed, and misinformation is not a crime. Misinformation means you're saying something that isn't true. And you're actually allowed to say whatever, you're allowed to make mistakes. You're even allowed to deliberately tell someone a lie. That's not a crime. People are supposed to be intelligent enough to be able to sort out, you know, what's true and false or what, you know, influences them. And the only time speech is limited is if you're defaming someone, but that's you know, you can sue them for defamation, or if you're crying fire in a theater, right? Otherwise, you can say if you're Joe Schmo, you can say whatever you want in your personal capacity or even in your professional capacity too, with some limits. Like, I can't advise people to drink hemlock, of course, as a doctor. But,
incitement, true threats, and defamation are key exceptions to protected speech.
Thank you. So everything, the rest of my speech is protected by the First Amendment. Let me say that again. By law, I can say whatever I want. The government, however, has fooled us, because we don't understand the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, into thinking that people are supposed to report misinformation. As the Surgeon General said, report it to the government. You know, we're giving you a website where you can go and make reports and call, and people have been encouraged to call the boards of medicine in their state if they think a doctor is spreading misinformation or another health professional. So in my case, two strangers that I've never met, and neither one knows any of my patients, apparently contacted my medical board and said I was spreading misinformation. And the medical board said, we're going to investigate you for that. even though, as I said, it's not really a crime. It's not a crime in law. It's not a crime within the statutes that govern what medical boards can do. But they said, we're going after you. And they were encouraged by a private organization, a charity, an NGO called the Federation of State Medical Boards, which probably was paid off and was encouraging all the medical boards in the country to start going after doctors who were spreading misinformation. Well, what's misinformation? In this case, it was anything that you said critical of the vaccine, either efficacy or safety. If you were saying hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin work for COVID, or you didn't believe in masks, or you didn't think masks would be effective the way they were being used for COVID, all of that was designated as misinformation. And so many doctors, hundreds or thousands in the United, I think it's thousands, because we know in Michigan, hundreds of healthcare professionals were being investigated by their boards. So all these doctors got letters saying basically cease and desist or we'll take your license away. And probably most of them did cease and desist. And in my case, I got investigated for these two allegations of misinformation. But then the board, you know, there were three lawyers on the medical board staff. And so they must have realized that misinformation would not be good enough if I fought back to charge me with. So they went looking for other things, and they charged me with prescribing ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine to three people. And they said, okay, and then they immediately suspended my license without a hearing. So I never got to tell them anything about what I had been doing or defend myself. And my medical license was suspended a year and a half ago as an immediate threat to the people of Maine. However, there is a statute. There are several statutes that govern the medical board, and one of them tells them what they're allowed to immediately suspend a license for. And in this case, I hadn't done none of the things I had done or they alleged met the standard for immediately suspending a license without even a hearing. So they realized they needed a better charge, so they ordered me to go see their neuropsychologist, who would allegedly claim that I was either crazy or demented or a substance abuser. If I was crazy, demented, or a substance abuser, that would have been sufficient to take away my license. Anyway, my lawyers, the board assumed I would not fight back. It's extremely expensive to fight back, and I was 70 years old. And I would never make enough money to pay the costs. So they thought they were safe, and I'm sure they were directed either by the governor's office or by somebody in Washington to do this to me, because it made the national news the next day. And I did fight back. And so by the time they started a hearing, they said, look, we're not charging you with misinformation anymore. We're dropping that. We're not charging you with prescribing hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, because those were both legal drugs and I was legally had the right to prescribe them. You know, we're going to try it when we're going to find something else to complain about. So they came up with some bogus charges that I'm incompetent at reading the medical literature. Otherwise, you know, why would I have prescribed ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine if I could read and knew that they weren't effective? And, also that my records and my care of patients was not adequate. So,
that's kind of what happened, and they made those charges. It's like in Franz Kafka's The Trial, you know, where he never knows what he's being charged with. In your case,
right.
They charge you with this, and then, oh, well, no, we'll charge you with that. No, I guess that's not true, but we'll just make something else up.
Exactly. So now, so I've had five hearing days. The hearing isn't over, but they've rested their case, and they weren't able to substantiate any of the charges that they brought, but they still haven't dropped the thing, and they have not reinstated my license either. But
so
anyway, they
when
knew enough not to go to court on the misinformation charge. And you'll find over and over again, the government does not want to go to court and fight against the First Amendment.
And you can see why not with this ruling from Judge Doty, this Missouri versus Biden ruling, where, you know, it's this judge apparently is still thinking clearly, and he notices that there's such a thing as the First Amendment.
Exactly. So So this is a huge case, and let me go back a little and explain it. So the attorney generals of Missouri and Louisiana brought a lawsuit against the federal government, against Biden, for censorship and for colluding with social media companies to censor their citizens. And then they were joined in this lawsuit by a wonderful organization called the NCLA, and I don't remember what that acronym stands for right now, but it's basically a First Amendment. It's an organization that fights against the administrative state legally in court. And so they represented a bunch of doctors, including Aaron Cariotti, who was lost his job at the University of California as a professor of ethics and psychiatry, and Jay Bhattacharya, who had been censored for being a co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration. And anyway, so this case has been proceeding, and Judge Doughty of Louisiana has allowed for some discovery, and this discovery has been very interesting. It's similar to the discovery that I know of from the Twitter files. I haven't gone through all of it, of course. I've only looked at a little, in that it reveals, you know, information about an enormous spider web that the federal government has created and funded with the help of social media companies, for-profit organizations that are, you know, they are paid to figure out how to better censor us, and universities. And so there are at least 64 universities that have received at least $40 million from the National Science Foundation for their work with misinformation. This includes places like MIT, Harvard, University of California, University of Michigan, Georgia Tech. The best universities have been encouraged to develop little sub-departments of censorship, you know, because you need people with a social science background and a computer science background. So and apparently, according to Mike Benz, who has founded the Foundation for Freedom Online and used to work for the State Department in their cyber division and knows how some of this was set up, you can even get degrees now in this sort of censorship, censoring misinformation. This whole plague of misinformation has been built up to be so big that probably billions of dollars a year are being spent to censor it.
It's kind of a successor to the study of conspiracy theories, which became a big thing after people like me helped push the 9/11 truth movement into public consciousness, and it posed a bit of a threat to the dominant ideology. And so a whole bunch of money suddenly appeared funding these professors to write about conspiracy theories and how we can fight against them. And now, of course, it's just metastasized, and this anti-misinformation thing has gotten huge, as you say.
Huge, absolutely huge. So it was being managed to an extent through CISA, Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, and they had a $3.8 billion a year budget. Congress gave them $388 million more than they asked for last year for funding. But as I said, this whole operation was being funded also by DHHS and their sub-agencies. There's a list of 70 or 80 FBI agents who were colluding with Twitter to censor. And Twitter was being paid even when Trump was president. They had already started this. And Twitter was being paid $200,000 a month to compensate Twitter staff from the federal government to carry out the orders the federal government was giving them about who to censor and how to censor.
And so, of course, it's our tax money paying for all of this.
Exactly. Our tax money paying for and this whole operation was illegal. Now, social media companies are allowed, you know, private companies can censor you. I mean, there's no law that says they can't. But there is this incredibly strong First Amendment law and case law that says the government isn't allowed to. The federal government can't. And in my state law, the state of Maine also has a law that the state of Maine can't do this to me. So it's very interesting that all these lawyers and people in government decided that they could get away with ignoring this and create this whole enterprise, which of course is being used to, you know, for what appears to be globalist purposes, for control and surveillance. I mean, this whole thing, they're surveilling everything that everybody sees. So they know what they can't censor you if they don't know what's coming to your inbox, right? So they're looking at everything. And anyway, Judge Doughty on Independence Day issued a 155-page order with over 700 footnotes saying the government, that he agreed to order an injunction, a temporary restraining order against the government to stop this until the case continued and, you know, came to its final conclusion. In order to get a restraining order, the judge has to determine that there's a very high probability that the plaintiffs will win. So that's what happened 2 days ago. And yes, last night, the government said, we're filing a motion. We want to appeal this. We don't go along with this. We think that the censorship was really important to prevent harm to the American people.
And now they have to explain what kind of harm will be prevented by having the government leaning on the internet companies to censor us.
Exactly. So this is going to be interesting and fun. The problem is that, you know, we know what's going to happen. The government will somehow manage to get this out of Judge Doughty's jurisdiction at some point and try to put it in front of a judge who they control. And so we'll see how well that goes. But hopefully there are many judges who understand that the First Amendment is really the basis of freedom in the United States. And without it, we don't have any. And
I'm not that surprised.
But it's a hugely important case, hugely, hugely important, probably the most important free speech case, you know, in 100 years.
Yeah, you know, Meryl, it doesn't surprise me that the administration, the executive branch, and the FBI are doing these completely unconstitutional things because, of course, they do that stuff all the time. But what is kind of surprising and disappointing to me is the reaction of the academy and, to some extent, the courts that permit it. Fortunately, Judge Doughty is an exception to that. But when I got into the academy, the whole point, I thought, was that this is a place where we can argue on the basis of evidence and logic. And the more unusual your viewpoint, the better, as long as you can defend it well. And so, it was supposed to be a place of searching for truth, using totally free speech, outside even a lot of the sort of boundaries of polite normal society. I always thought that's what the academy was all about, and there's a certain tradition that tells us that is what it's about. And so now suddenly we have these multi-billion dollar, anti-misinformation, anti-conspiracy theory sort of Orwellian mind control programs, and the whole universities are getting in lockstep behind these party lines, and they're not tolerating any dissent. Anybody who dissents from their party line is being called a misinformation purveyor and a Putin bot and things like this. That's not the academy that I signed on for back in the day. Of course, maybe having been kicked out of it maybe that was a sign.
Well, it certainly did have that tradition. What we've come to see, and was it Janet Mayer or someone else who wrote a book showing how foundations and rich people acting through foundations and entities they controlled were taking over various institutions in the United States, particularly the academy. And then the other half of that is that, everybody in the science faculties and engineering is working on basically government grants from NSF or NIH or another agency perhaps, but, Department of Energy, something like that. I know that if Fauci wanted to blackball you, you are not going to get ever another grant from the NIH. So the only people who survived in the academy, and you need, right? If you're in science, you have to get grants to pay your salary. Otherwise, very often you're just thrown out. Certainly at the better schools, the so-called better, you know, the Harvards and MITs, if you're not getting grants to pay for your work, you're out of there. You don't get tenure, or they find a way to make you leave. And so basically, it wasn't that hard to control people and to get the yes men into those positions, because they'd always been trained. They'd already been trained. Just like doctors, we had already been trained. We had to suck it up. We had to use this electronic medical record that made our work much harder. We couldn't look at the patient anymore. We had to type in nonsense into a computer while we saw I actually left the hospital and went out on my own at that point, because I said, I'm not doing this. You know, my professionalism, my relationship with patients is too important for me to become a drone, you know, who types. So in order to fill in a lot of boxes that the computer spits out, it wasn't about taking care of patients anymore. It was about filling these computer boxes in so you could bill so your hospital, your employer, could bill at higher rates. And it was completely crazy. But, you know, everybody who stayed in the system, and at least 75% of doctors are employees, had to go along with it. And so, there, you know, you've got all these people. You've already pre-selected them for obedience. And now you really make things difficult, and you've got people who are going to go along, and the ones that won't leave. And so then you have an academy and a medical profession that is willing to do anything they're told, pretty much. And I think the fact that they withheld treatment for COVID, when doctors are not supposed, you know, don't come to the doctor until your lips turn blue, when that goes against everything we've ever done before, you know, you treat patients when they're sick. You don't wait till their lips turn blue. That's crazy. It makes no sense. And that they were all willing to go along with this anti-common sense, anti-humane program, you know, indicates that they've already lost their soul. They already, you know, have been so damaged, probably traumatized and probably brainwashed through some sort of process they've been put through. I know that the training of doctors is extraordinarily hierarchical, and so you have to behave the people who are ahead of you or else. And so it starts there.
Yeah, it's very sad that it's reached this point of forcing this kind of herd-like conformity on professions that are supposed to be places where intelligent people can think and investigate freely. And of course, there's a lot of pushback against this now. There's the populist pushback against the censorship and this kind of herding people into a ever more controlled society, with the end game being some kind of a global society, one world state. And, you know, and Meryl, before we get off of the topic of who's paying for all of this and the way money is being used to keep people in line, we should keep in mind, of course, that the military is a huge source of funding. The federal budget includes, you know, a big portion of it is military. And then when they, you know, got rid of the BioWar program, moved it from the Army over into the disguised public health arena after Nixon signed that treaty in the early 70s, there's been huge piles of military money getting channeled into supposedly, you know, public health related stuff. And I think that's one of the keys to COVID. You know, my take on this, and I know you've been open to thinking about this, although I don't think you've said it quite as directly, but it sure looks to me like one of the reasons that they didn't want any treatment with ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine is that they wanted to sort of hold out and have the mRNA vaccines be the silver bullet. And the purpose of that is that the geopolitical West has, the U.S. empire, let's face it, has a huge lead in mRNA technology. And that means that if mRNA technology reaches the point that you can end the pandemic in 60 days, that means that your bioweaponeers can threaten the world, threaten your enemies, and then you've got the antidote, and so you control the world. So I think that's why.
Yeah, no, I would disagree with you. I would agree with the first part and disagree with the second, because you can't use them as antidotes. These are very dangerous vaccines,
and they were trying.
The way they're made is, you know, they can't be made safely. So you wouldn't really want to inject people that you needed to stay alive with these products, I don't think.
Don't you think they could have been over-optimistic, kind of, you know, drinking their own Kool-Aid?
They wanted, the fact that they wanted everybody to have the vaccine, and they went to such great lengths to bribe the churches, the fraternal organizations, you know, pretty much every organization they were able to reach was bribed to try to push the vaccines onto as many people as possible. And now they're trying to push future vaccines onto Africa by actually sending over little manufacturing plants so Africa can put the vaccines together themselves and then presumably be more successful at convincing their public to take them. I think that there was another reason to vaccinate us, and because the military was so involved in managing the program, I don't think that Pfizer and Moderna were at the top of the heap giving the orders. And the military obeys orders. You know, they don't come up with these crazy ideas themselves. They carry things out. And so I don't know why the mRNA technology was chosen. But it was and I don't know why the spike was chosen, but I'm sure there were many people who understood that by producing the code for spike protein, knowing that the spike was dangerous, understanding how spike proteins in other similar viruses acted, this was a deliberate, malevolent thing to do. Now, of course, most of the people involved with making the vaccines wouldn't know about this, but the coronavirus scientists would have. Plenty of people in the NIAID, you know, Fauci's agency, should have known this. And the FDA was warned by Dr. Patrick Whalen from the University of California, an MD, PhD, who wrote to them and cited literature about how dangerous this spike protein could be. Before they issued an EUA, Bobby Kennedy wrote about it in The Defender. You know, I posted on my website about possible risks. I didn't know how bad things were going to get, but one could predict that this was a risky thing to do. And then when they started using the vaccine, the injuries started piling up immediately. So it turned out there were 50 times as many anaphylactic reactions, anaphylactic shock reactions, as the average for all other vaccines that get reported to FDA and CDC.
And that's based on VAERS data?
No, it was actually quicker than VAERS, although there was some data from VAERS as well. So the Brigham and Women's Hospital has 50,000 employees, and they gave out the vaccine, and their occupational health center that was in charge of the vaccines, you know, surveyed everybody for side effects. And so they published a very brief correspondence about this in the JAMA, I believe, pretty early, like January or February of, I wrote an article about this the end of January of 2021. So I think the JAMA article actually came out a little bit later, a couple months later. But there was enough data from either VSafe or VAERS that I was able to write an article and show this and compare the rates of anaphylaxis with the historical rates. Pfizer, Moderna, FDA, the rest of the federal government knew very early what was going on with the vaccine. I think they knew ahead of time that the efficacy was going to start falling off quickly after 2 months, and that is why they designed the original clinical trials for efficacy to be checked at a median of 2 months. And then they vaccinated all the control group, so we could not see what happened to efficacy with those original, you know, I think it was 40,000 people were in the trial for Pfizer and over 30,000 for Moderna. They all got vaccinated.
They don't seem to like genuine controlled studies with, you know, actual control groups, do they?
They like controlling the control group. Yeah, controlling the studies. So, you know, everybody says, you know, pay attention to the science. And I don't want to throw science down the drain. But I have to say that, you know, there's very little you can trust in clinical research. If there is money involved, you know, if there is some benefit to coming up with a certain answer, you know, the researcher is probably going to come up with that answer. And they, you know, they're being censored by the journals. They're censored by their sponsors, because if a drug company is conducting a multi-center clinical trial, the company is often going to prevent any of the individual centers from seeing all the data from the other centers. So only the company and their people can analyze it and write it up and publish it. You know, they'll put everybody's name on it. But, you know, I've heard stories about this from researchers, so I know it happens. And sometimes if the researcher, you know, blows the whistle and says, well, this is what the data actually showed, again, they can lose their job. They'll probably never get an academic job again.
Wow. And so how would you characterize the studies or the literature on the issue of vaccine safety, and in particular the deaths caused by the vaccines, which, of course, the number of those have been estimated anywhere from, of course, the establishment says close to zero, or at least not a whole lot, up to estimates in the many millions. And there's been, you know, there's more and more evidence accumulating that would seem to suggest that there is at least some harm, and at least, you know, a fair number of deaths. You cited a UK government study from March 2023 that young women had increased risk of death during the 3 months after they were vaccinated, and there are more and more of these studies. Which ones do you think are most important?
So in the United States, it's really hard to get data that I feel is accurate. The CDC they have the raw data. They have a tremendous amount of data, although they pretend to Congress that they don't have the authority to demand all the data from the states. And so what they have is only, you know, say 40 states instead of 50, or missing something else. But CDC gets every death certificate. So they know what's going on. But instead of telling you, what they did for COVID was to redefine cases and deaths, you know, the cause of death and who was a case. So if you got if you had a positive PCR and you were asymptomatic, you know, maybe you were just going in weekly because you wanted to go to work and they required a weekly test, and you tested positive, they called you a case, even if you had no symptoms. And if you died of anything, you know, in the beginning of the pandemic, if you died of a gunshot wound or a car accident, and you had a positive test within 30 days, in most states, the CDC, or maybe all, CDC directed them to call it a COVID death. And when the death certificates came into CDC, they hand coded. The deaths. Every COVID death got hand-coded, even though 80% of other causes of deaths are machine-coded. You know, they get the information from the state, they just, good, you know, they don't do anything to it. But they had their hands on every COVID death. And so they were recoding deaths differently than what happened at the state level in some cases. So CDC, you know, redid the definition. They paid the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists, which is kind of an offshoot of CDC, at CDC sponsors. They paid them, and they gave them 8 CDC advisors to come up with very complicated case definitions for COVID cases and deaths. And this then enabled them to throw a lot more people into the COVID case and death categories. So if you were dying of pneumonia, say, and it could have been a different kind of pneumonia, but if a hospital thought it might be COVID, they were allowed to call it a COVID death. And if they did, they would get paid a higher reimbursement rate for the hospitalization if it was a Medicare patient than they would otherwise, by a long shot, like a triple the amount, say. And so hospitals were encouraged to call people COVID, even with a negative COVID test. They were told by the CDC, go do it, and they were getting a lot more money. So anyway, the statistics in the United States are all messed up. And then by May 1st of 2021, the CDC instructed the hospitals that not to report breakthrough cases in vaccinated people unless they had had a PCR test with a cycle threshold of 28 or less, which means unless they had these extremely high titers, extremely high number of virus particles in their nose or throat, and if they died, or if they, maybe if they were hospitalized, I can't remember. But the CDC, you know, cranked down the requirements so that very few vaccinated people would be reported as COVID deaths, whereas they were cranking up the criteria for unvaccinated people. You know, you were still positive if you had a PCR with a cycle threshold of 40 or even in some cases 45. And the PCRs, in my view, were intended to be basically the whole, if you looked at all the PCR tests together in the United States, you couldn't interpret anything because the FDA had allowed more than 250 different PCR tests, and these are proprietary, right? So you can't find out what they're using as a probe or what they're using, you know, for reagents. They don't have to tell you. It's proprietary. And they all came in under emergency use authorization. They weren't licensed. If they're licensed, they might have to give you the information, but they weren't licensed. So FDA just said, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Anyone who wants to offer a PCR test or an antibody test, go ahead and do it, and we'll just accept the results. And FDA said, you can send us the paperwork that would allow us to issue the EUA. You have weeks to do it. You can offer the test. This happened in the middle of March of 2020. Go ahead and offer your test and then send us the paperwork, you know. And they continued the EUA, so they never licensed any of them. So we don't, you know, if you have a PCR test, you don't know what they were testing for. You don't know what the sensitivity or specificity of that test was.
That must make it hard.
You don't know anything.
Must make it hard
and
to compare.
You can't sue anybody if it's the wrong answer.
Right. And also the question of efficacy in terms of do the shots actually reduce cases or not. Obviously, you can't tell that if you're having different PCR thresholds for vaxxed versus unvaxxed.
Exactly. In a completely, completely crazy. So none of the statistics in the U.S. really are usable, except possibly. So what was interesting was these insurance company statistics, and there were different insurance companies in different parts of the world have reported that people who were working, so these are relatively healthy people, they're still going to work and they're working enough hours to get life insurance through their employer. And so in that age group of 18 to 65, supposedly deaths were up 40%. And the reason you can say that is because people in that group don't die that much, right? If they're still going to work every day, most of them don't drop dead. You know, most people who die, they've already been sick. They've stopped working. So that was very interesting information, although it didn't separate the vaccinated from the unvaccinated. So you couldn't say what was, you know, that the vaccine was causing their deaths or had any contributory effect. But you could say, wow, there were more of these young people dying in 2021 than there were in 2020 by a long way. Mm-hmm. And then you get little bits of information, like the information out of England, in the UK, England and Wales, and then sometimes you get Scotland and Northern Ireland. That information has usually apparently been accurate, and I think maybe because they have two sources of information. They have two different agencies that collect these data. And maybe the people in the two agencies, you know, they couldn't make them both fudge the data the same way at the same time. I'm not sure. I'm guessing. But in any event, they do have two different agencies, and they issue reports, and they don't always issue the reports you want to see. You know, it's somewhat, I don't know how they decide what to issue each week, but they do issue some interesting information. So I only happened to stumble on one that they issued in March, which pointed out that in this very specific age group, and only women aged 12 to 29, in a period of about a year and a half, women who had received the AstraZeneca or the J&J, and in England, most of them got AstraZeneca because that's a British company and they bought a lot of that. If they received those vaccines, not the mRNA vaccines, in the 3 months after being vaccinated, they were dying at a rate 3.5 times higher than after that first 3 month period. So, you know,
Almost a smoking gun? I mean, is that a big enough increase?
Yeah, I would say so, but it's probably a relatively small number of women. So I don't know. I didn't see how many died, and they claimed that it wasn't true in men. Well, you know, again, you'd have to look at the numbers.
Yeah, hearing a lot. Young men have anecdotally, you know, been the majority of the cases we've heard about.
Right. Well, men are getting myocarditis from the messenger RNA vaccine, but these women were getting blood clots from the adenovirus vector vaccines. They're both getting spike protein, but it's different. So the Johnson & Johnson and the AstraZeneca vaccine had genetically engineered an adenovirus to produce the spike protein. So they were infecting you with this adenovirus, a chimp adenovirus, because adenoviruses can also affect humans. And there were a lot of women getting blood clots in these large veins around their brain. And I think about 40 or 50% of them who were diagnosed with that died. It's a very serious condition, cavernous sinus thrombosis. So there were some prominent people. I mean, there was somebody who was a BBC presenter who died as a result of this. So the Brits were more aware of that problem. I think, you know, when we make the revolution and we stop having criminals running the government, there's a lot to clean up so that we can actually get good data and figure out what's going on.
Do you have any hope?
Unfortunately.
We're going to be able to do that. And do you think the RFK Jr. candidacy would be a sufficient vehicle for that?
No, I don't know. I mean, I think he definitely wants to do something like that. I sure hope that RFK gets elected or somebody like him who will try to clean up this mess. Because right now we're spending 20% of GNP on healthcare. And we're getting, you know, very bad return on investment. We have the worst health of any of the developed countries. And now we've been given these poisonous vaccines. And, well, according to the CDC, 80% of the population has gotten at least one of those shots. And 68% has gotten at least two. But only 34% have taken any booster, which is interesting. So, by the time they got to the boosters, which was, you know, later in August or September of 2021, two-thirds of the people didn't want them.
Once bitten, twice shy.
And by the time they got to the bivalent booster, which started last September, only 17% of the population has taken one of those.
Yeah, that's right. There's been a kind of a conscientious objection from further boosters. It's interesting. Do you think that means that those of us on the sort of COVID vaccine skeptic side are winning the PR battle, that things are swinging in our direction?
Well, so PR, if by that you mean advertising, television, and mass media, no, of course. I mean, they've won that battle. They're still telling us it's safe and effective and the best thing since sliced bread. But I think, most people have figured out that they don't need the vaccine, that COVID has become very mild, and all of us now have some degree of immunity. The immunity is not 100% by any means. You know, I've gotten COVID more than once, and most people I know have, but it's partial. And so it means you're probably not going to have as severe a case because you've already had it, or you've been exposed. You never got sick, maybe, but you still have antibodies because CDC admits that they monitor people's antibodies. If you donate blood, they're checking your blood for antibodies. And there are other ways that they check. So they say that basically 100% of the country has already been infected with COVID. So it's not going to be that bad. And the boosters don't work. And if they've listened to me, they'll learn that after a few weeks or months, the initial brief and limited efficacy from the vaccine becomes negative. And that means once you've been vaccinated, you actually become more susceptible to getting COVID. You know, so that's a very bizarre thing.
These are really not.
After being vaccinated, it actually makes you more likely to get sick or to get the disease.
Are we absolutely sure of that? I've certainly seen studies that indicate that people are more likely to become cases after they've been vaccinated. The more vaxxed you are, the more likely you are to become a case.
So I am 100% convinced of this, and the reason is because of two data sets that,
and we only have about 30 seconds
CDC,
here.
CDC has had its hands on and yet released. So it's that meant CDC was not able to hide this. So the data were very compelling. One was all data.
Okay, I'm sorry, Meryl. We hit the end of the show. The bumper music is in our face, so we're gonna have to say
sorry.
But thank you so much. That's tremendous information. People should definitely check out your Substack. It's a go-to spot for the latest on these issues. So thank you so much, Meryl Ness.
Thank you, Kevin. Happy travels.
Thank you. Come visit us.
I will.
Okay. Bye.
We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crip Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's hyphen, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
All right, thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of my live radio show. I'm Kevin Barrett, broadcasting Truth Jihad Radio.
Hello.
Here on Revolution.Radio, the finest in listener-sponsored free speech radio networks. Please do support Revolution.Radio and support me, Kevin Barrett, by way of my Substack, kevinbarrett.substack.com. You can get early access to these shows by paying, what is it, like $6 a month or something. And by doing that, you support my work. I don't have to take any money from the government, Soros, or the Heritage Foundation, or any of these people that try to herd us into their preconceived cookie-cutter ideologies and propaganda modes. I just look for the truth wherever it may be, and it's a privilege to be able to do it thanks to you. So let's get going with our second bio-war expert. We had Merrill Ness on in the first hour. Now, Barry Kissin is a resident of, well, he lives pretty close to Fort Detrick, Maryland, and he got involved in the pushback against the 2001 anthrax false flag attack, became an expert on that, and he's a great guy in a lot of ways, and he just published a really good article, terse, succinct, and to the point on how this blame the Russians for everything thing is getting way out of hand. And I couldn't agree more. You know, the censorship is all because any dissenting opinion is Russian propaganda, and that's the excuse they're using for all sorts of evil deeds, up to and including, well, hopefully not, nuclear war. So let's talk about it. Welcome, Barry. Hey, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Kevin. You know, we're doing this on a phone right now, but I could join call Skype if you want to do that.
Okay. Well, pick one or the other. And
okay, I'll join call on Skype.
Okay, and hopefully
I just clicked on that. Sorry for this.
Hopefully we won't have an echo or anything like that. And there you are on Skype. And just you can turn off your video, though. We only need the audio. Your good looks are wasted on the audience. They're only getting your audio.
Thanks. Now, just help me with this a little bit.
But now you got
let's
the
go back to the phone. We'll go back to the phone.
Okay. You just got to pick one or the other. Hang up one, stick with the other.
Gotcha. Sorry about that, man.
That's okay. Yeah, that echoey voice, though, that's, you know, that you could be a rock and roll singer, you know, like Lux Interiors of the Cramps with that kind of echo in your voice. Just
I didn't catch the reference there but okay.
We do have that, don't we?
Yeah, we've still got the echo, so you need to get off of one of those two modes.
Okay, I'm sorry, man.
Okay, yeah.
Close his window. Boom.
Just hang up the Skype. Click the little hang up red button on the Skype and stick with us on the phone. How's that?
That sounds super. Unfortunately, we're still doing this, and I thought I got out of Skype. I thought I'd exit out.
So I'm sorry about this.
I'm sorry about this.
Instead of comparing you to a rock and roll singer, I'm going to have to...
for me to hang up that phone.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Have you call me back.
No, I think you're good. You're good now. Yeah. You're good. Just, Barry, just turn off your camera, and
Kevin?
You'll be fine. Yeah. Kevin? You're good. I think we still have you, Barry, except we don't have your audio. You're going to have to unmute. Well, here, maybe I should hang up on his Skype. Okay, we got him kicked off, and now we're going to reconnect. We're going to get Barry back on here. He's too eager to join the show. He's joining us on his phone, on his Skype, and who knows what else he's coming up with next. We're getting, like, all these different Barry voices when we really, really need just one voice here. Hey, Barry, are you there?
You hear me?
Yep, I sure can.
I don't know why you can't.
And one more thing to do if you can figure it out is just...
Hello? Hello?
Yeah. We hear you. But apparently you need to turn on your audio, turn on your headphones, something like that. Okay, well, I guess I can tell people more about Barry's article while he's figuring out how to get connected here. It's called Ukraine and the Apocalyptic Blame Game, published at Global Research. And Barry points out that the letter signed by 51 former top intelligence officials claiming that the Hunter Biden laptop story has all the classic earmarks of a Russian intelligence operation was just one example of this. Blame the Russians for everything and lie about it, right? Blame them for a political story that isn't going to go your way. Blame them for the Zaporizhia nuclear plant sabotage that we're all expecting. Blame them for blowing up their own Nord Stream pipelines along with their own nuclear plant. Blame them for blowing up their own dam, the dam that they control, so they don't need to blow it up if they can just open the gates if they want to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Barry is pointing out that blaming the Russians for everything is it's going way overboard.
Well, can you hear me now, Kevin?
Yeah, you're good, Barry.
Super. Sorry for that mix-up.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, I mean it's the pattern that we see over and over again, and that we've been so conditioned to think in terms of, is this absolute evil that warrants even bringing us to the brink of all-out war? That is the linchpin. It's persuading everybody, and some way or another it continues to do it in instance after instance, that this is absolute evil and we must go all the way it takes to deal with it. That is it. That is it. That's the paradigm.
Yeah, that's kind of an American thing, don't you think? That, you know, Moby Dick captured that aspect of the American character with Ahab just totally obsessed with the ultimate evil of the white whale. You got to follow it to the ends of the earth and then go down with it. And it seems that our politics does that, Kevin.
I'm not sure we should go back to Herman Melville at this point.
I'm not blaming him. You know, I'm just saying he diagnosed it.
Well, but how about this? I mean, what I think is beyond appalling is just the state of the culture at the moment. I mean, it appears that movie after movie is just about coming up with more gruesome special effects. And it's always supposed to satisfy this kind of primitive desire of ours to see good prevail over evil. I was doing a little bit of it myself yesterday, just watching the good guy, you know, beat up on the bad guys. It does. I mean, it's a way to, you know, it connects with something primitive in us, and that's what's been so cultivated to the point where people are stupid. I mean, stupid with it. It's beyond stupid, though, isn't it?
You're not saying the American people have been dumbed down, have you?
Yeah. Well, I you do a lot of these conversations, and I'm not sure I'm going to say anything you haven't heard, but, you know, to be honest. But anyway.
Yeah.
Come on, Kevin.
A whole lot of my guests seem to think that the American people are getting ridiculous lies from the mainstream media and only seeing through them some of the time. But the good news is that they do see through some of them some of the time, and... You know, they're not voting predictable ways anymore. You know, they're voting against the media for Trump, which has its downside, of course. They're voting against the media, or possibly going to be voting against the media for RFK.
Yeah, but let me make this point. Let me make this point. I've learned it in a lot of ways, but I remember my eyes being open to it years ago when I was spending a lot of time on Capitol Hill. And what you see is that the New York Times, Washington Post, close behind, they are treated as the media of reality. That's it. That's the touchstone. That is starting to fray, certainly, particularly with these crazy Republicans. That's starting to fray. But it still kind of holds sway, I think, throughout the power structure. And of course, what's convenient is that the power structure is generating the damn nonsense through these organs. So that's how it works, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. Right, I was talking with Meryl Ness in the first hour about how the big money, corporate money, but then also government taxpayer money, is used to pursue these kinds of Orwellian objectives, you know, brainwashing people about COVID and vaccines and such, and persecuting the dissidents. And so, yeah, I think a lot of it is the military-industrial complex is making its money off of war, so they always have that huge incentive to keep pushing it. But, you know, I think you're right that there is definitely a kind of a psychological issue where, you know, the manipulators have taken advantage of the human nature. You know, we love to see a fight, right? The Irish proverb says, if you want a crowd, start a fight. And we want to cheer for the good guy. And the manipulators have figured out how to get us all excited. And the fact that we're hating on Russia and Putin strikes me as a real testimony to the brilliance of these evil propagandists who've managed to make us hate these people that we shouldn't be hating. I mean, really, seriously, folks, is Putin, like, particularly bad compared to other examples of leaders? And is Russian?
No, come on, Russia's Kevin. We've done it over and over again. Yeah. We've done it over and over again. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, you and I lived through the run up to the Iraq War. We lived in the run up to the Syrian garbage. The run up to Libya. I mean, I think again. I mean, they are portrayed as absolute evil, no holds barred. No holds barred. That's it. Yeah. That's how it works. And it's total distortion of reality. I mean, complete upside down, largely. I mean, look. Does anybody spend time listening to Putin? I mean, he is more learned and articulate, and I would say, what's the word, centered, than anybody close. There's no so-called statesman in America to come close to that.
Yeah.
Not even close.
I can listen to people like, you know, RFK Jr., Ron Paul.
I'm talking about people in power, yeah.
Yeah, and the people in power. You know, like Joe Biden, he has to kind of to stutter his way through the teleprompter lines he's being paid to read. But yeah, it's like you're right. But Putin, he's like RFK Jr. He can go off script and impromptu and talk intelligently for hours at a time. Obviously, smart, competent leader.
Let me tell you what it reminds me of. Right, you're gonna have to help me with the pronunciation. I'm rusty. Ahmadinejad from Iran. How do you pronounce it exactly?
I guess Ahmadinejad.
Okay. So anyway, so now do you remember this? He comes over to the United States and goes to Columbia University and openly takes questions. Remember that?
Yeah. And
Can you imagine the reverse? I mean, for one thing, of course, we maintain this.
I've gone to Iranian universities and openly taken questions.
Yeah, right. Well, exactly, but, right.
Yeah, I don't
exactly
think Biden. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, just extraordinary. So, and that's the nature of this guy Putin. I mean, he goes out there in front of all these, you know, these international media people, and you know, what do you got? I mean, what do you got? And then he starts, and after they got nothing. They're not penetrating anything. Look. I don't know. I'm not the first guest to say this to you. I don't know whether it matches up with you. I expect it might. All right. I'm not going along with this obligatory, you know, initial sort of statement about Ukraine that goes, Putin, you know, violated international law and violated a boundary, and he's a thug. which unfortunately happens to be the word that RFK Jr. uses more than once. I ain't going with that. I ain't going with it. I forgive RFK Jr. for doing it, all right? But it is. He's you use the word placating. You know, he's placating this primitive, you know, this primitive condition we're in, where there's absolute evil and absolute good, and you know, if you get too associated to what we view as absolute evil, that's immediately disqualifying. So he's avoiding all that. He's placating
the beast. But just like with Israel, he's placating that.
Well,
beast
no, I got it. I got it from your term for Israel, and we can talk about Israel. We can talk about Israel. You know, you and I have differed on that in the past. I'm not sure we want to do that today. But
yeah, maybe I don't know if we're that different on that. Here.
No, we're not that different. To spell it out, it probably deserves to be. You know, I've never gone along with, sorry for using his name, the Chris Ballin thesis that. You know, Israel masterminded 9/11. No, I mean, I'm just not doing that. I'm not doing that. I understand that they're significant, but no. They ain't the dog. They're some other appendage. So that's where we differ, and that's fine.
I guess we do a little bit because, I think that the Zionist network tentacles into the American deep state has been involved with certain of these big crimes that have been relevant to American Mideast policy.
I know you have. So, but we don't have to. Let's not split that here at the moment. Okay. But let's take you up on your reference to the deep state, and let's just get back to this to where I jumped off on this little piece that you were talking about. I mean, it's spectacle after spectacle, and if you plumb the depths of any of them, it turns the system inside out. Right. So here's another example. Right. We've got all the top intelligence people in on this. We got all the intelligence, including the Michael Hayden. That's important. Right. This is a bipartisan thing.
Are you talking about the war on Russia, or are you talking about the Hunter Biden's laptop issue?
Yeah, I jumped back to the beginning. Where my piece jumped off was I reminded everybody that on October 20th, 2020, all these intelligence officials get together to say that the Hunter Biden laptop is Russian disinformation. And they put that out there, and the mass media works runs with it. And then my line in the piece is, it works like a charm. It sure did. It worked like a charm. It's a perfect example of manipulating an election.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they got social media to ban discussion of this issue, and you couldn't even post the New York Post story.
It took mainstream media 2 years after that to admit that it was genuine. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Did you see the New York Post editorial on this? The New York Post is actually justifiably pissed off about this.
Well, of course. Look, the New York Post. I mean, the New York Post lays it out. So let me tell you the tidbit that I came across. A little while ago in the New York Post, because I was thinking about talking about this article, they recite the fact that one of Hunter Biden's clients happened to be a nephew of Whitey Bulger, a nephew of Whitey Bulger. Nice little tidbit.
Small world.
The reason it's a nice little tidbit is because, a very valid characterization of Joe Biden is gangster.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about before this call, I was thinking about how mellifluously these guys lie. Mellifluously. I watched Anthony Blinken, right? And I was watching Anthony Blinken specifically because it's the point at which he's being asked about generating this letter, right? Which, as I point out in the piece, the acting CIA head, former acting CIA head, testified to Congress. Blinken was the one that initiated this, right, mm-hmm. when he was a campaign worker.
Yep.
Kevin?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're asking, but here he went. So fine. So now they're asking Blinken. Okay, you know, what about this? And I'm watching him real closely, right, because he's nailed. And he comes up with this kind of, I don't know, call it what you will, sophomoric grin, right? And then just spiel something, you know, that as far as he's concerned is enough cover. That's it. And walks away from it. Right? I mean, just comes up with whatever, whatever he can slap on it.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever he can slap on it. That's all nice little grin on his face and stuff. I mean, so look, what are we looking at? We're looking at what we know is there, but it's quite palpable, right? It's quite palpable. These guys cultivate lying. They practice it. It is their practice. It is what they accept you need to do in order to succeed in politics. They accept that from the beginning, and they get good at it. And when I say get good at it, I mean, an element of that, of course, is they are the kind of characters that have no conscience to bar it, to inhibit it. There's no conscience to inhibit it. These are the guys that are you know, making their way through our political system.
But the problem is, right? there are no consequences when they lie. Like you said, Blinken, you know, they ask him that question and he just deflects it and walks away, and nobody really keeps just going after him. It's as if
how about the letter was signed by everybody, Kevin. I mean, do we need to spell it out? I mean, you know, John Brennan, of course he's on the damn letter. Of course Leon Panetta's on the letter. Of course Michael Hayden's on the letter. I mean, yeah. I know Clapper's on the letter. Of course Clapper's on the letter. I mean, what is that? How can you even... I mean, so let me just jump to something else and get to a question that I really have. You know, okay, so now we know, it's taken us long enough, most of us knew it a long time ago, the CIA killed Kennedy. All right? Boom. Now we know that. Now we know that. And because it hasn't achieved, again, I think you go back to the sort of official recognition, which is in the media largely, because it hasn't achieved that, even though no one has any reason to doubt it, we continue to do business with the CIA just like we always have. They're still the ultimate arbiter of all of what we're doing, you know, foreign policy wise.
And nobody said, you know, we have to tear them into 1,000 pieces and scatter them to the winds, you know, ever since JFK said that. RFK Jr.
That's mistaken. That's mistaken. RFK Jr. has repeated that quote many times. Many times.
Hey,
I'm sure you've heard him say it. I'm sure you've heard him say it. I mean, he quotes his – look, I mean, so look, you know, I've expressed it elsewhere. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., all right, for all of his placating, all right, he's not going to back up like Bernie Sanders. It ain't going to happen, all right? He's already got both feet and his arms practically to his neck in it. He's called out the CIA. He's behind that. He's called out the military-industrial complex. He's behind that. He's unfortunately, most likely, 60 years too late.
Well, better late than never.
Well,
yes,
I'm glad you said
that. Something about this a long time ago. I mean, when
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, when I
I don't know.
I
mean, you know,
it really pissed me off.
I'm glad you said that, Kevin, because because you've been you know, look, I mean, one of the things as a commentator you're called upon to do, and there's plenty of philosophical ways of doing this, is to, shall we say, equivocate about the RFK candidacy. You know, I understand commentators are led to do that, and that there are, you know, sound philosophical grounds perhaps for doing so. But no, it's not appropriate. It's not appropriate when you recognize the span that he is trying to stride over, the span, how far away we are from ridding ourselves of the military-industrial complex, how far we are away, how entrenched it is. From top to bottom, and he's taking them on explicitly. It's impossible. But to equivocate?
Yeah.
Well, no, you can't equivocate.
No, yeah, it's like the best thing happening in American politics since they killed his father and his uncle. Absolutely. And
there you go.
But
There you go. That's it. Yeah. You and I are eyeball to eyeball on that.
The truth the way I see it. I'll tell that truth. I'll also say that I love his commitment to truth, but I have a little problem with some of these equivocations. However, that doesn't negate the fact that compared to everything else out there, I mean, his candidacy is really monumental. And, of course, I wrote him in 2020, you know. I mean, I so.
Oh, did you really? Okay, so fine, Kevin.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you say so? You wrote him in. Oh, I love that.
It's a protest vote.
I love it.
This is a perfect protest vote.
Oh, God. No, that's a distinction right there, I got to tell you, Kevin. That's a real distinction.
Yeah, it was kind of weird when, actually, I think he announced his candidacy when I went to Morocco and ended up having this serendipity thing, you know, when we discovered this house that we'll be moving to soon in Morocco. And the news that, yes, he actually was running was kind of weird. It was kind of like, you know, I should have copyrighted this. You know, I'd be rich.
No, sorry. I didn't quite catch this. When did this happen?
Well, when he announced that he was running, it happened back in, what, March or whenever it was. And that was that was right when I traveled to Morocco. I had jet lag and I was in this different culture that I hear. Whoa, right. he is actually running, you know. And, you know, I thought this was my crazy idea for a protest vote.
Okay. I got you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
It's like when you have a crazy idea and then it sort of comes true somewhere and, you know, you sort of wonder, what's
you put it really well, because it's something that I've tried to put into words, and you found some good ones. The way when you say he's the closest we have since they killed his uncle, since they killed his father. That's kind of a break point in my, you know, in my cosmology. That's a break.
Yeah.
That assassination. That's a break point because RFK, I do believe, would have taken a whack at that, at the prevailing paradigm. You know, the might versus, you know, the might makes right. I think he would have taken a whack at that. I'm sure he would have because he was going to expose the CIA. I mean, he was personally in it.
I think those brothers both, you know, learned pretty fast, you know, once JFK got in office. And, you know, on that quick, steep learning curve, you know, they actually developed a lot of potential. And it was really tragic that their lives were cut short because they, you know, they had that potential to kind of correct the course, this evil, doomed, you know, Captain Ahab course that the empire was drifting on at that time. And by, you know, letting them be cut down like that, we really allowed the country to go in the wrong direction for all of these decades, like most of our
lives. It was, as the scholars put it, a coup d'etat. It was a military intelligence coup d'etat from which we have never recovered.
Right. And, of course, there's the Chomsky position, which is, oh, it doesn't really matter. They're all just bourgeois. But I don't think that's true. James, you know, JFK and the Unspeakable, that, you know, he makes a pretty good argument that there really was this major, you know, sort of change of perception that, you know, Kennedy underwent during the last year of his life, and that, you know, he was ready to take on the military-industrial complex and make, you know, a serious effort to reform things. And
I don't, Kevin, see where that's debatable at all.
Yeah.
And I don't, it's not debatable at all.
It's one of those areas.
And
where
as
Chomsky,
far as,
you know,
well, listen, Chomsky, look, I mean, some, look, you got to say these about certain, you got to say this about certain things, right? You did a diatribe against Chomsky. To tell you the truth, I wasn't very enamored of it. But as far as what he just said, what you just quoted about the JFK assassination, plain and simple, silly, okay? So Chomsky, we're not going to consult you on this. Let's get back to the subject at hand. It's just plain silly. I mean, what do you mean it doesn't matter? That's silly. I mean, doesn't matter. Lyndon Johnson was the military-industrial complex's boy. That's what we got. We went from one thing to the other. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Come on.
And there's also that difference between, like, the complete corruption of somebody like Johnson and the basic, more or less, integrity that then became much firmer at the end of his life of somebody like JFK.
Well, you keep bringing that up. So you've now tempted me too much to interject this. I discovered this when I read the autobiography of Timothy Leary. It becomes much clearer in that book whose author you interviewed about the death of Mary Pinkin.
Yeah, Peter Janney.
Exactly. And what's going on there in Last Year of Life, among other things, is experimentation with psychedelics.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting how apparently Miri Pinchot-Meyer became sort of the breakthrough wife of the Washington Wives Club, who are these wealthy socialites in the D.C. area married to rich, powerful, or influential husbands. And they took up with Tim Leary after Leary kind of got onto a guru trip after, you know, he left Harvard and set up at Millbrook and attracted these women. And they all, you know, they took LSD, experienced expanded consciousness, and realized the folly and futility of the corrupt and warlike ways that they were ensconced in back in D.C., and they decided to sort of conspire to get their husbands to wake up, too. And so Miri Meyer had an affair with JFK. I guess she'd known him since college, and they took LSD together, and there was serendipity, apparently. JFK was already fed up with the military-industrial complex, which had brought the world to the brink of World War III during the Bay of Pigs, and they'd lied to him, and they'd deceived him, and they'd just done all this nonsense, and he realized how bad they were, and that may have contributed significantly to that turn towards peace that James Douglas writes about in his book JFK and the Unspeakable. So, yeah,
yes, I
basically agree with you on that, Barry. And again, I do think there's an Israeli role here there too, because I think that.
Well, before we get to Israeli, please. Before we get to Israeli, come on. Before we get to Israeli, let's just mine this a little bit further. This, because I mean, you talk about Israeli all the time, but you don't talk about psychedelics all the time, and the influence it might have had the humanity, well, the evolution of humanity influence it might have had. You know, look, he's not taking LSD in a vacuum. He's taking it in the emergence of a cultural revolution. That's where he's taking it. And, it gets squashed. It gets squashed, you know, across the board, including in these extremely consequential assassinations.
It kind of turned into a bad trip, I guess. Of course, LSD.
Well, you're making jokes. You're making jokes. Are we on a bad trip? Well, it's a funny thing, Kevin. Not to get too abstract, but are we on a bad trip? Well, you know, I don't know. There are certain things I very much appreciate about life. At the same time, as I feel extremely burdened by this direction that we're in and how things are operating, right? And of course, you have the same thing.
Yeah. It's for me, it's not so much really about, you know, all of life, which normally when I can, you know, just kind of let go and see what's really there, I can experience life as a tremendous blessing. But the society that I was born into, you know, went off, you know, was already drifting in a very bad direction when I was born, and that direction became considerably worse when JFK was killed and then later his brother. And so I've had the misfortune of growing up and spending pretty much my entire life in this society that just really went badly off the rails and has failed to live up to its promise and potential. And, you know, some people, like, you know, my friend philosophy professor Peter Simpson is a skeptic of the whole political liberalism project. And he might have a point that it was destined to go off the rails by its own inner contradictions. I don't know. But in any case, I think there are some positive...
No, what is that? Come on, Kevin. What is that? I'm sorry. That's not good. That's not good stuff. That's not good stuff. I mean, look, let's get back to the assassinations just for starters. Come on. I mean, these are very consequential events. This is not... Yes, I mean, look, we're in the middle of a cultural revolution. And these guys were getting it. And they were ready to lead it. And they were popular enough to do it. It's probably our last chance. We are talking about our humanity's last chance to transcend the paradigm of might makes right. The last chance. That's it right there now. And then this RFK Jr. pops up, and it's impossible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, they plot and God plots, and God is the best planners or plotters. And so,
oh boy, you know, oh boy, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's
God plots. I wasn't
plot.
Sure about that.
Yeah, that's
you're funny. You're funny. So no, so let me just make it straight. I mean, we'll get it straight here. So really, we conspiracy theorists embrace God in this too, don't we, Kevin?
Yeah. Kevin? Well. Yeah, I mean, there is actually there's a long connection there between theology and conspiracy theory that we probably better not go too deeply into.
Okay,
but
it's up to you.
But in this case, I think that we don't really know for sure. So I don't think it's as simple as like, okay, let's all pull this voting lever for RFK Jr. and if enough of us do that, we save the world. And if they
no, I don't think you've been hearing me say that, have you?
No, I know. I'm being
all right, okay.
But my point more is that for the world to evolve in a better direction, it could happen by way of better leadership in the U.S., theoretically at least, but it could also happen by way of the U.S. empire kind of getting out of the way, and it could very well be that the next phase of history and, you know, the next geopolitical order will no longer have the U.S. at the center as the most powerful entity, and it may be considerably better. And it may be that the single most powerful nation will be China, and that will have its downsides as well as its good sides. But one of the good sides is that there is not a history of predation, military predation, going out and looting, raping, and pillaging other nations far, far from home. Chinese have really never done that, and they had opportunities, and they didn't take advantage of them. So it might be a more peaceful world, more geared towards
Kevin, yes, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and what you've kind of highlighted is the key thing, which, you know, we have a lot of reasons to be pessimistic about. You know, the fulcrum in what you just said is that somewhere or other, we move this terrible American empire to the side. Unfortunately, the folks running it don't care about human life. All they care about is holding on. That's the problem we're looking at here. We don't have a Gorbachev on our side.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Yeah.
Not even close.
I think it's a symptom of the nature of the American oligarchy. You know, we've always had this, you know, freewheeling plutocratic oligarchy. You know, democracy, I think, is not the right term for how America has ever been governed. It's always been governed primarily by power, and power in the United States has mainly grown out of not so much the barrel of the gun as just the money. The richest, you know, you can pretty well quantify power by how much money somebody controls. And so these
I'm not sure what you meant by it hasn't been by the gun.
Well,
it's been by the gun the whole time.
Yeah. Okay. What I mean by that, Barry, is that there are many other nations throughout history that have been more sort of military geared, you know, military empires where the leader of the military is in charge of the whole country, and the wealthy individuals in that country do what the military backed government tells them to do. I think the United States is the opposite. I think the United States is a country where the richest people use their wealth to buy military power, and the military basically just does the errands of the plutocrats. So we're a plutocracy rather than
a military. Yeah, that's right. And you're making me think of the continuum, where if you go back even further, right, this main military man, was out on the field wielding a sword. Remember that? Right? And so, you know, gradually they become, you know, the technocrat. You know what I mean? But they're just handmaidens of the oligarch. You know, but you know, let's characterize the oligarch. I mean, let's characterize it. And this is what is so chilling and so really unbelievable is that there's this, if you will, and let's dissect it if you want, this psychopathic element. This religion of maximization of profit. This religion has basically turned all of these movers and shakers into viewing maximization of profit as the only valid goal, regardless of collateral damage.
Regardless.
That's right. I mean, literally, regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think that is linked to the dominance of so-called political liberalism, which holds freedom as the highest value, which is not always a bad thing. But in this case, what it ends up doing is that this ideology of freedom for everybody to pursue their own ideas of the good leads the predators to pursue their idea of the good, which is money and power. And they pursue it with extreme ruthlessness. And because we have this ideology of liberalism and allowing people the freedom to do their own thing, we give the oligarchs the freedom to do their own thing. The psychopathic oligarchs
have
the freedom.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't have a CCP to rein them in. We don't have a Putin to rein them in. We don't have a Saddam Hussein or a Gaddafi to rein them in. We don't have a supreme leader of Iran to rein them in. And so our plutocratic oligarchic psychopaths just run everything.
Right. I mean, the last president we had who was contemplating just that was JFK. That's it.
Exactly.
Otherwise, they're handpicked. They're handpicked. That's it. That's the change. You know, let's not get any more abstract. I mean, than that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But there
no, we, it's fine.
There's a structural problem here, too, though, I think, which is that, you know, the power of sort of one inspiring individual like JFK to completely change this whole system, which is built on the ideology of liberalism, which has allowed the creation of this super corrupt oligarchy, that, you know, one guy like JFK could somehow reform the system in such ways to inspire the people to put teeth in the state, and the state would then enforce virtue and take away the freedom of these oligarchs to make as much money and power as they want. That's a big order for one guy to have to fulfill.
Well, it was a big order then, but I keep coming back to this. He wasn't happening in a vacuum, right? This is the beginning of the 60s, 70s. That's what this is. Okay, and that's why you know, you say RFK Jr. is like came out of nowhere, because we're 60 years away from that. We're 60 years from the emergence of something that, yes, operated on all those levels. Operated on all those levels, right? I mean, we were seriously talking about overhauling education. We were seriously talking about overhauling mental health. We were seriously talking about overhauling the culture. I mean, all that was going on. There was real ferment then, real ferment. We don't have it. We don't have that. And you need all of that. Of course you do. Of course you do.
Yeah, there certainly was a moment of cultural ferment back in the day. You know, it's funny you mentioned that right now, Barry, because right here in front of me at my desk, I have a bunch of my old underground comics, which illustrate those values. I'm getting rid of stuff as I go to Morocco, and somehow this pile of old, like R. Crumb and, you know, Freak Brothers
ripoff comics
showed up. And I looked into that a little bit just to see what it would be like to read it now, many decades after I've even looked at that stuff. And you know, a kind of a pleasant anti-authoritarian spirit shines forth from the pages of these underground comics. You know, they were very subversive, I guess, back in the day. And even today, the spirit of some of these comics is closer to the spirit actually of the Trump voters than to the spirit of the people on the so-called left. Like, most of these hippie left-wing type 60s people have now, you know, become this most, you know, a horrible kind of, you know, conformist. And the sort of freewheeling, troublemaking spirit of anarchy that illustrates these rip-off comics, R. Crumb and so on, that spirit, to the extent it still exists anywhere, you'd actually find more of that among the populist pro-Trump elements. So things have really changed.
Right, so here's another tidbit out of the corner of my eye. Marjorie Greene, that lunatic, Marjorie Greene, she wants Hunter and Joe to take a drug test.
I love it, yeah.
She's
like the Abby Hoffman of our time.
Well, you're going pretty far there, aren't you?
Yeah, maybe I'm pushing that comparison a little bit. But
you might be pushing that a little.
That was the kind of, you know, humorous, barbed kind of thing that Abby did, though, back in the day. And to see somebody like Marjorie, you know, doing it now from a total...
To be honest, I take it somewhat seriously.
I take it somewhat seriously.
These guys are sleazeballs. They're sleazeballs.
Yeah.
That's what they are. They've been that the whole time.
Yeah.
They're sleazeballs.
And it kind of drives me crazy that the sort of straight, you know, Democratic voter types, including people who are fairly intelligent in many ways, don't get that.
I'm having the same problem. There's a Facebook page. You know, all the Democrats in Frederick counties participate in this Facebook, and you would not believe the willful ignorance. It's worse than that. Half the time they're just abusive. You know, it's like you can't say anything. It doesn't matter. Look, I mean, I'll give you a quick example. Right, let's just kick it around just for a moment. For crying out loud. I've got a paywall, so you probably read the article, right? But I get the gist, right? On June 5, the New York Times puts on its front page, well, yes, the Ukrainian army is awash with Nazi insignia. You read the article, I guess.
Possibly.
You don't remember that one? June 5.
Oh. You know, I don't have an encyclopedic memory of every New York Times article, Barry. I'm sorry.
No. This is no. Come on now.
In my rainbow swastika satire piece?
Probably. I can't be sure of that myself. But come on now. This is front page. All right. Well, now we're going to admit what we've been denying assiduously from the beginning. All that nonsense about Zelensky's a Jew over and over again. Right. And now we're going to say, yeah, the Nazis. Yeah, you know, it's all over the damn place. I mean, look, you can't. It's not like it's so out in the open. It is so out in the open. Stepan Bandera is a national hero. They celebrate him. They're still naming stadiums after him.
Yeah. That is so strange, isn't it, Barry? Because, you know, we're constantly being told that there's this horrible.
This is freedom
threat.
And democracy.
Yeah, we have this horrible threat of white nationalism, and it's very, very anti-Semitic, and these people are basically Nazis, and Trump and all his followers are all a bunch of Nazis, and this is the ultimate evil in the world, and you know, we're force-fed this by the media all the time, and yet, what is Ukraine? I mean, if you want to find one thoroughly Nazified country now, it's Ukraine, and we're the ones that made them that way.
Well, yes, I mean, something I read carefully. You know, Covert Action does a good job on it, you got these declassified documents right now. And the CIA is in Ukraine, you know, training and equipping and, the Nazis, the Ukrainian Nazis, you know, and the target is Russians. The target is Russia. That goes all the way back to right after World War II.
So what's your take on, you know, why it is that they're, is this sort of Jewish disproportion in terms of supporting these Nazis? It just seems weird that, like, Victoria Nuland, she's you know, from the Kagan family, this neocon Jewish family of great influence. Zelensky, of course, like the majority of Ukrainian oligarchs, including the ones Kolomoisky, supporting the Nazis there, you know, he's Jewish too. So there's this disproportionate element of Jewish people who are pushing Nazis in Ukraine. Like, what's that about?
Yeah, well, and the answer is they're natural allies. They're natural allies, and the ultimate objective has nothing to do with Jewish or religion or anything. You know, the ultimate objective is to consolidate power.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And the Nazis are
you know, are pretty good at that. You know, they'll stick their necks out there.
So getting back to your article about, you know, blaming Russia for everything, I think it's a very timely article, partly because of all this talk about the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant with false flag accusations coming from both sides. And
I mean, we happen to be doing this conversation right now, and I happen to be in a kind of relieved state. But just a couple of days ago, the Washington Post made a headline out of Zaporizhzhia, you know, Russia's going to attack and blow up they made a headline out of it. I mean, now, and of course, just so all your listeners are on board here, this is 10 days after Blumenthal and Graham, right, introduced that resolution that explicitly says that if the Russians blow up the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, that will be attack against NATO, Article 5. That's the resolution. You know that.
It looked like a big setup for the false flag.
It's basically an invitation to false flag. Yeah. It is invitation to false flag. Right there. Just right there. And the Washington Post, you know, right behind it. Right behind it. Headline. You know, and the amazing thing is, isn't it? I mean, you know, I understand people are saying, you know, people aren't even taking the mainstream media seriously. But they're still throwing weight around. We already discussed that during this conversation. They're still throwing weight around. And they get away with S-H blank T like that. In this case, the day later, right, the international body, what's it, IAEA, whatever it is, right, the Atomic Energy, International Atomic Energy Monitor, right there, who, you know, I saw him give the statement on France 24. I saw him give the statement, and then it was written up. And this is what he said. This is what he said, Kevin. He goes like this. He says, well, listen, I don't want to get in an argument with the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. He's a good friend of mine. Right? He's got to do all that. Right. And then he comes up with, we are making no such observations. That was immediately, you know, and what is the ramification? What is the ramification? I mean, how much more clearly can you be caught? Well, look, you know, we started this with that letter in October 20th. I mean, that's just one more extremely compelling reason to extirpate the CIA. Right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. But also...
And it's like water off a duck's back.
Yeah, it's also a reason to end the war by any means necessary before it turns into World War III, because it's, you know, we've seen some good pieces by people like John Mersheimer and some other very highly placed experts pointing out that this is looking really bad. I mean, how can this possibly end other than World War III?
Because you don't need to be an expert. I mean, yeah. Look, let's just lay this out. Now hold it now, because let's just lay out what we're looking at in the next few weeks. What we're looking at in the next few weeks, right, is, correct me if I'm wrong, all right, counteroffensive flat on its face.
Not right? Going to correct that, you.
Okay. All right. Now, NATO has got two choices. One is to accept that. There's no precedent. And the people that make the decision are psychopaths. The other option is to escalate. That's it. You need, and look, you, I'm not the only one, and I'm sure you were doing the same thing. And of all people, one of my favorite people, Ray McGovern, was doing the same thing. Ray said a couple of months ago, look out for a false flag. He said that a couple of months ago. Ray did. Look out for a false flag. Now, I think the world took Zaporizhia nuclear power plant away. I think they took that one away.
Mm-hmm. The IAEA, you mean?
Well, they helped. You know, that doesn't happen in a vacuum either. But yes. Because the damn thing is, I mean... Apart from the fact that everybody's not paying attention, the ones that are, there's nothing subtle about this. There's nothing subtle about it. It's as plain as could be.
Yeah, they're sure. You know, these lies are so bald-faced. You know, when Hitler called them the Empire of Lies, Hitler called us the Empire of Lies.
We are now talking about an excuse.
Yeah.
An excuse for World War III. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
But the logic of it is kind of disturbing because, you know, neither side is willing to back down. It, you know, for the Russians, it's obviously existential. For the U.S., it shouldn't be, theoretically, but because they've committed so strongly that, and the neocons are in charge, they think it's existential too. So
that's right. That's how they play the game. They play the game, we're going to make this existential too. And that's, you know, that's demonstrating to you complete disregard for, it doesn't matter, American population, Russian population, Ukrainian population. It's not like we don't know what these people are made out of. Look at what they've done to Ukraine. Totally unnecessarily. Let me just say it, because I don't know where else to say it. All that idiot had to do in December was say NATO's not going into Ukraine. That's all he had to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have saved a lot of lives and a lot of pain, trouble, money, and a lot of other things. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And then torpedoing the peace plan early
That's right.
When Boris Johnson flew in to torpedo the initial agreement. Yeah, they didn't want an agreement.
Well, exactly. Consider this for a moment, right? The Africans come and visit Putin, right? Putin pulls out the document. He's got Ukrainian signature on it, right? No mainstream coverage.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. They don't want any diplomatic solution of any kind. The Minsk Accords, they admit now that was just to buy Ukraine time so we could arm Ukraine to the teeth.
They all admitted it. Destroy
Russia.
Yeah. They all admitted it. Merkel said it. Poroshenko said it. Holland said it. They all admitted that. And that's terrible. That's terrible. Because the only solution here is the Minsk Accords. That's the only solution here.
Right. So when Putin says that the other side is non-agreement capable, that he's actually probably understating the case.
Well, exactly. I mean, look, he's probably under some pressure from being taken in 2015. And it's very easy to say in hindsight, but I mean every word, he should have been in there in 2014 when they were screwing around in the Maidan.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for us to sort of second-guess that kind of thing because we don't really know what the strategic equation was. There's one school of thought that says that the Russians had to beef up their nuclear deterrent because these neocons are really almost right up front with this notion that they think they can win a nuclear war by striking first.
Oh, yeah.
Kresge wrote a good piece about that for the UNS Review that I highly recommend people check out. He's stating this strong thesis, which is that the whole Ukraine war has been orchestrated by the neocons for the purpose of getting to the point where they can justify a nuclear first strike on Russia.
They're playing nuclear chicken. They are playing nuclear chicken. We're on the brink.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's getting crazier all the time. And whether, you know, how it all plays out, again, they plot and God plots. God is the best of plotters. So, inshallah.
And I'm glad an outfit like the IAEA, which is very politically sort of influenced, did the right thing because we all know this is what's at play. This is what is at play right now.
Well, the Europeans don't want all that radiation drifting over their countries.
That's right. Really they would prefer against that. Yeah, they would prefer against that. Of course, you know, they've gone along with a hell of a lot up until now.
Yeah, and maybe they'll stop going along with things before the nukes start flying.
I mean, I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't know how that's even possible.
Yeah, we're gonna have to leave it there, Barry, because we hit the end of
Kevin.
The hour.
Well,
great talking to you again. Always
great talking to you, Kevin, again.
Yep. Keep up the great work. God bless. Talk to you next time.
God bless, man.
Okay. Bye-bye. Barry Kissin. He's done excellent work on the 2001 anthrax false flag and various other topics. I'm Kevin Barrett of TruthJihad.com. Also, KevinBarrett.substack.com. Subscribe to get free access to the archives of these shows. Come back next week for more live radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern.